This is the Sam Russell interview for September 14th, 2005.
Hello, Sam Russell?
Yes, Mr. Russell, this is Anthony Young calling back.
Yeah, hi, Anthony. How you doing?
Is this a good time now?
Yeah, it's a good time now.
Okay, great.
Okay.
I hope you had a good vacation.
Well, I did. Yeah, it was great. Went to Vancouver.
Oh, okay.
Sailing there, yeah. It was quite a change from New Jersey.
Yes.
Yeah.
I used to summer in Ocean City when I was going to high school.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, I have a lot of fond memories of Ocean City, so, at least in the late 60s, anyway.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I was staying at the Seaview Hotel in July of 1969, and I watched...
Really?
Mr. Armstrong.
Landing?
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
We were all huddled around this television set in the lobby of the hotel. It was one of those...
Why is it that everybody remembers where they were?
Exactly right.
That was quite an event.
That TV camera that was broadcasting, that was the first RCA camera, is that right?
No, it wasn't made by RCA, actually.
Oh.
And that one, I am not sure, but I think it was Westinghouse.
Oh.
Now,
yeah.
there were two cameras on board that mission, and we had what was called a Block 1 camera, which could work inside the command module.
Mm-hmm.
It was a slow scan camera. I'm not sure whether it was used on Apollo 11. It was used on Apollo 8,
mm-hmm.
and it was the one that you saw the images out the window.
Oh, yes.
That was an RCA camera, and it was a slow scan. Originally, there was not a great deal of forethought put into the need for television in the early part of the program, and they had assigned a certain amount of bandwidth to television, and which was about a half a megahertz instead of 4 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
About an eighth of what a normal TV channel would be, and so it was black and white, and the frame rate was 10 per second,
mm-hmm.
And a little lower resolution. All of those technical things, but that was an RCA camera, and we called that Block 1.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
but the one that was saw the famous first step on the moon, I believe, was Westinghouse.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm looking at a note here that said the GOTCHA, to use the acronym, was based on the RCA Lunar Surface Color Camera, which was, I guess, the first RCA contract for the fixed. This is the one that I think some people vaguely remember as being, was it on Apollo 14?
No.
Where it got, or was it 12, where it got... inadvertently burned out or something?
No, that was a Westinghouse camera.
Also.
Well, I'm really not sure about the Apollo 11, but I am absolutely sure about that there was a color camera that Westinghouse made, which was to have been used, well, it was used in Apollo 12 and also on 14. 13, of course, never landed.
Right.
A particular type of sensor that was, if you pointed it at the sun, it was, it just couldn't handle the overload.
Oh, I see.
And so what the camera on Apollo 15 was a brand new camera,
mm-hmm.
top to bottom, including the imaging tube, which was specially developed for that project. RCA felt they had quite a stake in this. I don't know if I can tell you that their advertising campaign was, they considered themselves very much first with color television.
Mm-hmm.
They invented the color television that we now know today. I mean, the U.S. standard, and they really wanted to gain back some ground that they felt they had lost with Westinghouse having.
Okay.
And
so apparently RCA did win the contract for the J missions then.
Yes, that's right. The Gotcha was, I mean, at the top to bottom, was a brand new camera for the three J missions.
Okay.
It had a what they call a silicon intensifier target. The target actually was silicon for the first time, what we now have in CCD chips and so forth.
Right.
And it was really immune to the high overload that you get when you pointed it at the sun. As a matter of fact, we had to run performance tests of the camera looking at the sun for a long time. It withstood that.
I see.
So it was part of, it was one of the requirements. Hey, that's not going to happen again. Not after Apollo 14.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Apollo 12.
Right.
Yeah. They just wanted to make sure that wouldn't happen. Apollo 14, they wanted to be very careful not to point the camera at the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem they had.
Tell me a little bit about your background at RCA just prior to this contract being awarded to RCA. For development of this camera.
What would you like to know about my background or about RCA's background in this?
Primarily about your what your position was at RCA and maybe some of the your position on the development team for the camera, so I can put this thing in kind of context as it once it was awarded and the development time, some problems that were encountered during development, you know, that sort of thing.
Sure.
Had you been, how many years had you been with RCA?
I've been with RCA since the beginning of 66.
Okay.
And there's really some interesting connections here because I came to RCA from Houston. I was living in Houston at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for the Grumman Grumman Aircraft Company that built the lunar module.
Right.
And I was in flight control. I was really a Grumman contractor on site at Mission Control, working with them as kind of a resident consultant, if you will, on the lunar module and the development of it, helping to support their lunar mission planning.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just before, and I was hired by RCA when I was down there, so I had connections with the Manned Spacecraft Center, which is now known as Johnson
mm-hmm.
Space Center, my positions at RCA, I was hired into a systems development group, I was a project leader there, my first project at RCA was working on a concept for an imaging satellite, an Earth Resources satellite, which NASA was not really willing to undertake. They thought Earth resources and things like that would be handled by manned missions, and RCA was promoting doing this with unmanned missions.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's done on a regular basis now from satellites, both in synchronous orbit and in polar orbit, lower altitudes. So I was the head of the electronic design team on that project. And right after that, that got to the point where actually GE won the project for this first satellite, and RCA had won contract on it for the imaging system, which is a high-resolution TV system.
Okay.
So I was very much involved with very high-quality TV from space.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that kind of wound down, that system effort wound down, and because it was really the imaging system, which I wasn't directly responsible for.
Okay.
At that point, I was more in the systems engineering of the overall concept. And then after which never came to fruition, but it was a small, it's called a laser tracker. It's basically a small optical radar, which was intended for the J missions and would be set up just outside the where the lunar module had landed.
Oh, okay.
And would be able to track astronauts as they went around on their exploration, so that a whole datametric record could be kept of, you know, where they were, where they found something. It would, you know, they would have this thing that would be following a reflector that the astronauts would carry with them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that, you know, finally, and that's where I got to know Jack Schmidt, who was very much behind this. He really came out of Eugene Shoemaker's group.
Correct.
The USGS out in Flagstaff. He was very much in favor of this, and so that's how I got to know him, and we were doing field tests with this device out in Flagstaff on some of the Indian reservations out there.
Mm-hmm.
So actually with a rover vehicle, but nothing like what was made for the moon. It was a more conventional but electrically powered vehicle that went around. And
was that
the branch of astrogeology was really looking for how can we do science in real time?
Right.
And that was the big thing. Is that your phone?
It is, but we've got an answering machine. So.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. The camera that the program was really a very quick development program, and I'm interested in finding out how the camera was developed in relation to its interface with the rover.
Well, there were a lot of interfaces that we had, and that was one of the things that really fell right in my lap. Let me see. Let me just give you a timeline of the development of this. I don't know whether I had outlined it in the article that I had written, but I think we received the go-ahead and the contract in July of 1970 to go ahead. And at that point, we had a working breadboard, as it is called. It was a camera that was, I mean, it was all laid out on a flat on a big board, not miniaturized, and all of that, with the imaging tube and all of that, and we had demonstrated to NASA, you know, the working qualities of it, but we had really about 13 months from the contract go ahead until the flight, which was in July of 71.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the difficulties or problems or engineering challenges, however you want to word it, were not so much technically with how the camera worked, but with how big it was, how it would fit. As I recall, we did not have a great deal of interface with the rover. More important interfaces were with flight control and how to operate the camera. You know, it was remotely controlled.
Mm-hmm.
How to fit it on the lunar module. It went on one of the bay doors, or just behind one of the bay doors.
I guess in the mesa, as it was called?
I don't think it was on the mesa. The mesa, this was the bay door. I forget all the quadrant definitions, but if you're looking out the window of the lunar module, it would be the near right-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
Not the front, not the side itself, but an in-between section. There's a door there, and boy, down and pull the lanyard and open the hatch, and it would drop down, and the camera then, bang, was pointing at the stair with the steps.
Right.
On the front leg of the lander. Now, the kind of interface things we had to work out was, you know, exactly how that camera connected in electrically, and the video and all that, and how it mounted in there, and how it could be taken out of there easily. It had a handle on the bottom of it that so that it could be picked up and handheld. Then when the rover was released, which was in the exact opposite direction on the descent stage of the rover, the astronauts had to have an easy way of attaching this camera to the TCU, television control unit, which was on the rover. So there was that astronaut interface, if you will, having to be able to put that on the rover.
Mm-hmm.
The camera was mounted right up front, along with the Lunar Communication Relay Unit, the LeCrew, as it was pronounced.
Okay.
We have Gotcha and LeCrew.
Yes.
Both made by RCA. The LeCrew was designed and built, developed in Camden, at the RCA Camden facility.
Okay.
Camden, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
While we were in the Princeton East Windsor facility in New Jersey.
Okay.
Known as the Space Center or the Astro-Electronics Division.
Right.
Of RCA.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting from what you tell me that there, you really didn't have much involvement with the installation of this camera on the rover itself. It was, that may have, the mechanics of that were handled by Marshall Space Flight Center, or?
I don't recall that we worked with Marshall.
Okay.
I think we worked directly with Sam, what's his name?
Sam Romano?
Romano, yeah. I remember the interface with him. It was a pretty straightforward definition of where it would mount on the rover, which is right up front, alongside this lunar communication
mm-hmm.
unit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mounting was an interface. The power was an interface. The electronic interfaces were all between the Gotcha and the LeCrew.
Right.
That whole technical thing was, I mean, self-contained and was really not a part of the rover. I think probably the biggest problem we got into, researching what problems we had with the rover was after Apollo 15, after the astronauts had left. The rover and the camera were still operating.
Yes.
And it was hoped that the camera would operate for some time, just kind of exploring.
Mm-hmm.
From the position, which was about, I don't know, 7,500 feet away from where the lunar lander had been.
Right.
It operated, I think, for about 3 days. I'm not quite sure of exactly how long that was, but they were trying to get as much as they could, just panning and zooming in and recording whatever they could on the lunar surface, details that might be of future or scientific interest.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, while in the middle of one of these transmissions where they were transmitting, it just popped off. There was a question, well, did the camera fail or whatever it was. It was pretty well determined that it was a breaker on the rover that had probably overheated.
Hmm.
The time of the landing was roughly, if you look at sun time, sun angle, things like something representative of when they were they had landed, it was kind of mid-morning, maybe around 9:30 or 10, sun time. In other words, the sun was a fairly low angle. And then as the sun continued to climb, you know, the next few days, as the moon became more fuller phase and the sun was more directly overhead at sight, the temperatures on everything, the rover and the camera and everything, just started going up and up. And it was pretty much determined that it was a breaker, a power breaker on the rover that, that popped.
I see.
And, everything went off. I mean, we were analyzing the last frame of video to see, was it the imaging tube or was it some sign of electronics going bad or something like that. But no, just popped off, and it's exactly what it would be like if we switched the power off to it. So, I mean, that was probably the most exciting interface problem that I can recall with the rover.
Okay.
The mechanical and the power interfaces were relatively straightforward.
I'm sure that RCA did its own vibration, thermal, and vacuum testing on this thing. Is that correct?
Indeed, we did.
Okay.
Along with oxygen testing and dust, and we had to have tested in 100% oxygen. Everything had to be, after the Apollo 1 fire, everything had to be tested. Every piece of equipment, no matter whether it was inside or outside, had to be tested within a 100% oxygen environment. We did thermal vacuum, which simulated the mission. We had a huge thermal vacuum chamber in East Windsor. We did all of that testing, the thermal vacuum and the vibration testing and acceleration testing right there.
Okay.
And of course that was all observed by NASA on-site inspectors.
Did they dictate the testing environment parameters, or how were those, in other words, did they give you direction on what it was the situations, if you will, they wanted you to test the camera in it?
Well, it's really a combination of how the test is made up. As far as the thermal, that whole environment, it depends very much on the mission. I was not directly involved with the design of the thermal testing on it, but that part is really very much mission related, and we had a lot of input into that testing. Now the vibration and shock testing is more a matter of what NASA thinks the vehicle, the lunar lander, the Saturn, everything is going to impose on it. So they pretty much defined what the shock and vibration specifications, what levels they would be at, and what kind of a profile of vibration would be instituted during the test.
Okay. Were you? I assume then that once the Apollo 15 was underway, you, like a lot of other individuals or contractors, were in Houston or at some other at KSC at the time when the mission itself for landing really got underway. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was at all of the launches, and then I was in Houston in the one of their staff support centers. This one was for television, and it was Building 440 in Houston, which is in the complex.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there, observing, looking at everything that was going on, all the videos coming back, the raw, unconverted video. It was a field sequential system. I don't know if you've gotten into all that in detail or you want me to get into any of that, but the idea of the camera was that it'd be very simple-minded, and it was just really a black and white tube. I mean, it's not like a normal broadcast camera or a high-quality prosumer camera, which has three chips or three tubes and Explorer can't ever go to the moon with all these, you know, vagaries of how the picture is aligned and so forth. The idea was to make it the most simple, reliable, and the approach chosen by NASA was to use the color wheel approach.
Right, yeah, I read about that. What was it? Was it a nail-biting experience once they had landed and Dave Scott started climbing out?
Of course. I mean, you know, we had done everything, and but it's definitely a nail biter. I mean, we're really nervous about it. And, I mean, you just don't know. There's always the unknown factor of you've done everything you possibly can do. I mean, you've demonstrated it up and down, sideways, everything. You've gone through all of these tests, and still there's a little question that, you know, it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, it was definitely a nail-biting. A lot of coffee, and it was early in the morning, and it was like a, you know, a shock there. Wow, there's the picture. And just bang, right.
Well, I've been watching the, like I mentioned before.
Yeah, spacecraft film.
Yeah. They're digital.
Yeah, Mark Gray has done a nice job.
He sure has, hasn't he?
Been in touch with him, yeah. And I don't know, maybe if you've seen a late edition of it. I know that we were working out some problems where some of the first imagery, the color was really off, and we were working through something, and I think he came out with a whole new series of the Apollo 15 and maybe some of the others.
Well, 16 and 17, I think, I mean, I'm looking at the ones for 16 right now, which was just re-released, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just really, to be honest, I'm astounded sitting here. Here it was, 1971,
yeah.
And the image quality that got beamed back from the moon to the Earth through that whole network, and then it's to me today, I'm just amazed. I mean, I saw the last shuttle mission. I was looking at these TV images from the shuttle, and I'm going, I'm not impressed with this.
Yeah.
You know, if this is the best they can do today, how is it we could do so well 30 years ago?
Well, I'll tell you. I'm not going to make any comment today. I mean, I think they're able to get television looking at everything. I mean, being able to cover things and smaller, easier to use cameras and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot on the line to have it succeed. I mean, this is the first time, and I know NASA really wanted it to work. They felt that they had been convinced at that point, especially after somewhat disappointing performance of Apollo 14.
Mm-hmm.
The image quality was not really good, and Apollo 14, if my memory serves me, I think was in like about March of 71.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going in July of 71, and there was just a whole firestorm that cropped up. Well, how do we know that we are not just going to have a repeat of this on Apollo 15?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it was kind of an effort that was redoubled to make sure that we had done all of the things we could. I was involved in a lot of simulations where we ultimately I had started this at RCA, really building a model of a lunar scene and trying to light it and get the dirt to look about the way the lunar dirt would look, which is very dark.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately helped NASA set up a big simulation in Houston where we were mixing sand and lamp black together. Boy, what a messy scene that was.
Mm-hmm.
To set it up so that they really had a realistic simulation of
What amazed me about this camera is its ability to resolve depth of field both near and far, apparently, at the same time.
Well,
I mean, you had the astronaut right maybe a foot or two from the camera lens, and you could see the boulders in the distance perfectly focused. I mean, I thought that was amazing myself.
Yeah, well, the camera was very sensitive, and we had no lack of light.
Mm-hmm.
The silicon intensifier target tube, we called it the SIT tube, it's like a silicon vidicon tube, but in front it has an image intensifier, and the idea was that we might get into shadow, really dark shadow, and really, really need a lot of sensitivity. This camera had sensitivity in spades, and so we were able to, excuse me a moment.
Yeah.
Coming back from vacation rendered me a little cough.
Okay.
Along the way, excuse me once more.
Sure. Yeah, I do understand the concept, yeah.
Yeah, if you're able to stop down to F-16, you have a tremendous depth of field.
Mm-hmm.
Often that's problematic on inside scenes where you don't have a lot of light. And so it's a trade-off between if you really want to do deep depth photography, you need to put a lot of light on the scene.
Yeah.
It's a trade-off. But in this case, we had plenty of sensitivity in the camera. The camera sensitivity is variable over a range of 1,001 electronically. It was the voltage variable sensitivity. So the light control was really quite one of the really advanced features of this camera. Its ability to work in very, very dark and yet be able to handle, you know, high overloads like looking in the sun even.
Mm-hmm.
But the depth of field was enabled because we could stop the camera down and still we had plenty of sensitivity to get the image.
What was the post-mission performance review for the camera like? Was that within a NASA context, or was that did RCA hold its own meeting to discuss the performance, and what was the response type of thing? I assume it was self-congratulatory, but
it's never self-congratulatory. Well, I mean, it's briefly self-congratulatory.
Yeah.
And then, what are we going to do the next time? Well, I don't recall that there was kind of a major debriefing, but there were a lot of conversations that went on and meetings, and the big problem that happened in Apollo 15 was the clutch for the elevation of the camera, up and down, pan
mm-hmm.
up and down,
mm-hmm.
Had overheated, and when the camera was tipped back at all, the weight was over center. So it's like any camera on a normal tripod. If you tip it forward, it tends to want to go further forward, or
right.
tip it back.
Uh-huh.
And so what happened if you elevated it? You know, you tilted it up a certain amount, the clutch would begin slipping. There was one time during the mission, I don't know if you have that on the CD, where
we had to manually restore it
straight up.
Yeah.
And it took a while for, you know, the we were saying, you know, tip it back up. We were trying to get our word through to the mission control and
the CAPCOM and
finally they came through and said try to tip up the big eye or whatever it was.
Yeah, that was the nickname they gave it.
Yeah, the big eye was, so the astronaut actually had to tip it up. And then, if you recall, at the end of that mission, the last EVA, when they leave, the decision was made not to try to follow it up.
Right.
They because they would just tip over back, and they didn't want to take any chances. They didn't know whether the problem would recur. Once they got it set up, I mean, they didn't want to have to keep telling the astronauts to fix the camera again.
Mm-hmm.
So they only did that once, and then they were very careful about how they tilted it, just very minor.
Mm-hmm.
And so the liftoff there was just that locked-off shot.
Okay.
Stage, and it just goes, you know, poof, and it's out of the, it's out of frame. Whereas, so the big deal after that mission was there were two major issues. One was the amount of dust and glint, sun glint on the dust that was on the lens of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So when the camera pointed around where there was sunlight actually shining on the glass.
Right, you got all that particulate stuff
you
on there.
You can see that from the
well, you added a sunshade there.
Yeah, there was a sunshade.
For 16-17, I guess, then.
Yes, that's right. And we redesigned the clutch.
I see.
Yeah, those are the two modifications. There were a lot of other things we wanted to do. We had some scientists were after us to put in a longer zoom. We only had a 6-to-1 range of zoom on the camera, and so we were proposing a number of things actually.
Mm-hmm.
For 16, we tried to get the longer lens on, and also for 17. And then there was, I think 16 went pretty well. I don't recall that we had a lot of issues after that. There was one major issue, and that was that when the liftoff came, I had actually personally given NASA the time for the command to be given to engage the liftoff.
The vertical pan, I guess, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it blew out of the top of the scene. Top of the frame right away.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of immediate blame about the calculation being off, but it turned out that the astronauts had been told to park a certain distance from the rover, and they were in a rush and they just parked it where they wanted. It was too close, and there was no way that the camera could tilt up fast enough to follow them up. So that was something that was really fixed mainly by mission control. I was working with the flight control people, particularly Ed Sindel, who was the kind of chief camera guy there.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of him operating the little joystick there. Yeah,
well, he didn't have a little joystick. He had a bunch of switches he could punch. You're thinking of what you saw on the home box office. Right?
Yeah, so they lied, huh?
Oh, they lied. Yeah,
well,
they lied. Wasn't like that.
So a little misinformation there. Okay.
Because and the character they put in there is nothing like Ed Sindel.
Because I've seen.
I had dinner with Ed about a month ago.
Oh, did you?
Down in Houston. We were just kind of catching up on old times.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Ed is a very colorful, kind of feisty character, and
personally,
like this gentle soul that was, carefully moving this slider thing on the...
Well, it must have been frustrating for him, in fact, because, like you say, he had to use buttons instead of some preferred means of camera control. So, I mean, some people were complaining that the camera wasn't moving when it should have, but you know what, they weren't the ones trying to drive the camera, so...
Well, of course, you have a 2.5-second delay.
Sure.
On everything, so you have to anticipate.
And I thought he got very good at it toward the end there.
Yeah.
If you look at 16 and 17, he does a pretty good job of anticipating the astronauts' movements and getting the camera to follow around, so...
Yeah, he was good. And there were two guys, he and Al Pennington, main guys on the camera, and the ones that I knew, there may have been another, and I just last about a year ago, I talked with a guy who worked with Ed on getting the liftoff right on Apollo 17. They did all kinds of work on actually simulating how, you know, when to push the elevation. Of course, the buttons were, I mean, it's elevation up, you know, tilt up, tilt down, pan right, pan left, on off. I mean, they were just on off things. And he had to send the commands at the right time. And so they had figured out, you know, if the lunar module appears this big, then we know that we're so many feet away, and therefore that the angular rise is going to be at a certain rate, and that we need to punch the button at such time. And they did a lot of work on that.
I see.
Actually, I was chatting with a guy. I never met him until about a year ago down in Houston at a reunion. They worked out that problem to get the best they could for Apollo 17.
Let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
Who did the engineering then on the very high gain antenna, the umbrella type antenna, and that sort of thing? That
okay. Well, that was done by the group in Camden, New Jersey. The antenna, high gain antenna, was a part of the lunar communication relay unit.
Okay.
And it's that wire mesh umbrella like parabolic
right,
with a little visual sight that enables the astronaut to look at the Earth and, you know, get it in the crosshairs.
Yeah, I thought that thing just performed beautifully to get that.
Well, it seemed to have worked very well. The optical sight was almost useless, I understood, from the astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was to point it roughly toward the Earth and then look at the signal strength indicator on the lunar communication unit.
Okay.
And so they just locked it in, basically based on signal strength.
Are these are these two divisions, or are they still at those locations? Are the RCA divisions still there?
They don't exist.
Okay.
They're gone. The history of the RCA Corporation is that GE bought RCA.
Mm-hmm.
RCA had all kinds of divisions doing, and GE divested themselves of all of these except two. They kept NBC, and they kept the communication satellite business, and everything else they sold.
Mm-hmm.
RCA is now a brand. Philips Electronics in Europe, and RCA doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Any longer. So, and those the old buildings in Camden are now, I think, they're ready to be torn down, but I think they're now being converted into very high-priced condos. Right now, the old brick buildings, which was the original RCA buildings.
I see.
RCA started really in Camden.
Yeah.
Alongside of the Victrola, Victrola talking machine.
Right.
Company,
mm-hmm.
Which they bought.
That's right, Tipper and the Victrola.
Yeah, Nipper.
Nipper, I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's amazing how, American companies like this just have disappeared over the decades.
It is. It's a shame. Yeah. I don't know. I've read a lot about it, actually, in retrospect, and I've talked with, there's now the Sarnoff Library, which is the original library of the RCA laboratories, and
mm-hmm.
they are sort of operating separately and trying to reconstruct the history of what happened there. And I don't know. The way I understand it is, mainly David Sarnoff, who was really the genius behind RCA, put the corporation together in 1919, I think, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was eventually given over to his son, Robert Sarnoff, who would come up as NBC president and so forth, and he just did not have the skill of money in the late 60s, and
I get that.
It's a big story.
Yeah, it is.
That's one that I don't know a lot about. I mean, I'm just